Well, we have a rather curious subject today, but one that seemingly is involved in practically everything that happens on Earth, and that is the human mind. There are no adequate definitions as to what the mind is, but there is a reasonable accumulation of data concerning what the mind does. And under careful scrutiny, it is obvious that the mental equipment is definitely a mixed blessing. Now, why is the mind what it is? Well, it is part of a general government, collective and individual. The world is governed by attitudes, convictions, beliefs, opinions, and various research projects. And these, most of them, originate in the mind. The individual is governed by his own mental equipment, which he very seldom questions for the simple reason he has nothing to question the mind with except the mind. He has to analyze the thinking equipment. And, of course, for some unknown reason, the mind nearly always wins the argument. It does what it wants to do. Now, the mind as general commander-in-chief of the body is controlling a complete miniature empire, which we call the human being. This empire includes every type of life that is found in the larger theater of the world around us. This empire within us has its continents, its races, it has its arts and sciences, it has its transportations, and its own educational theories. It is a complete world, living and existing on three distinct levels. These levels are, for the most part, obvious, recognized, and in one way or another, misused. The physical body is the final basis of the human personal integration. This might generally, and is generally considered, a kind of blue-collar structure. It is here to work. It is here to do what the mind and the emotions want it to do. And the fact that the mind and emotions may not be very good about their own desires, this the body has to stand. The body has to accept the domination of superior instruments which are often dishonorable. So the body has to do what we want it to do. If we want it to be up and on its feet, it stays there until it falls of fatigue. The body has no recourse to anything below itself. It has to accept the final slavery imposed upon it by the mind and emotions. Now, if we didn't have a mind and did not possess emotions, the body would probably be inert and useless. The body of its own accord would be simply a creature seeking food, seeking to survive, but with no particular purpose or project in mind. The body is not an executive, but it is the victim of the large executive factions upstairs. And in this situation, the body is nearly always ignored. It has not any rights. But like labor, which is the great collective body in society, it has one power that cannot be denied. It has the right to strike. And the physical body makes use of this occasionally. When it has had enough of something, it simply announces displeasure. This announcement is accompanied by discomfort. And if the situation is too serious, the body may be subject to fatal consequences. The body, however, can revolt against the domination of that which is above itself. Actually, of course, there should be no need for such a revolt, because the superior part of man should respect the body, should realize that this structure is a commonwealth, that it has its obligations, its duties, and at the same time confers definite benefits upon the personality which it is motivating. So the body can object. And when it objects, what do we do with it? Well, in labor, when labor objects, we put in a few strike breakers to force them back into line. Well, when the physical body shows wear and tear, we do something to keep it going, but not for the primary purpose of making it healthy or happy. It's merely to keep it doing what we want it to do. And when the body no longer does what we want it to do, we wake up in a rather sad state. So we have a body physically that is subject to the tyrannies of both emotion and thought. Emotion stirs up things, gets the body into all kinds of difficult situations, presses various temperamental excesses which damage the structure and function of the body. The emotions of hate are just exactly as bad on the body as a poison gas. All the things that we do emotionally that are destructive injure the body. The idea that we can have a strong body and perverted emotions is simply unrealistic. But then most of our attitudes are unrealistic because we base them upon what we want to do rather than what we should do. Now, the emotional pressures against the physical body can result in a variety of ailments which are now generally recognized and are being studied. And these studies are very largely limited to psychoanalysis and matters of this nature. Actually, the emotions are also depleting and debilitating the physical body. They are adding to its wear and tear. They are struggling to preserve their own purposes. What the emotions want, desire being one of the most prominent of emotional functions, what they want, they demand, and there is no consideration for the consequences. We see this today in alcoholism, where the emotion, the mental nature, has condoned the use of alcohol, wishes to use it to inspire a certain confidence or to build a certain sense of joviality. And the body is the sufferer. The body has nothing to resort to as a means of getting out of the situation. But if the emotions and mind are too despotic, we will have delirium tremens, which will put the individual into a very bad state, if not an early grave. So what we want to do, seldom if ever, is based upon a concept of what is good for and what is best with the problems of the human body. Actually, therefore, we have to arrange in thinking that we have a neglected factor which all the doctors in the world have not been able to really keep going. The Chinese probably did the best of any up to the present time. Chinese people hire a doctor when they are healthy and well. And they do not pay him if they get sick. And this is the exact opposite of our method, but there is something more to it also. The doctor is therefore going to do everything possible to keep them well. He is going to move in and teach the individual the laws of living. In Chinese culture, the medical practitioner is usually a Taoist philosopher. He is capable of many types of magic, esoteric healing, and things of this nature, unknown to us in the West, and of course he has given us acupuncture and a variety of pharmaceuticals. But this Chinese doctor's idea is that if he takes the job, which he can refuse if he doesn't want to take it, then he expects the person he is keeping well to be a basically enlightened Confucianist. The individual who wants to stay well must become aware of the responsibilities of the superior person. The only way to stay well is to keep right. Now, there are, of course, accidents and things of this nature, which we cannot include, but the run and file of people who have no great special tragedy in their lives drift along without the proper amount of Confucianistic discipline. The doctor, therefore, reminds them that the superior person is the only individual who has the right to be healthy. An individual who doesn't keep the rules of life doesn't have any right to have a healthy body. He does not have any right to have a happy and comfortable relationship with his own physical structure. The moment he breaks the rules physically, which he does because of mental and emotional pressure, the body suffers. And if this goes on long enough, the Chinese physician must point out that the individual trying to do what he pleases rather than what he should is shortening his life and depressing his own actions and cultures. So the health began in China with being right. And it is simply true here. But how do you become right? This is another problem. Well, there is the first positive use of the mind. The mind, being the general in charge of the entire corporation, has a right to be heard and has the inevitable right to be right. Now, why is the mind not always right? Well, because we've never trained it properly. We haven't realized that the mind is probably the most important vehicle that we have in the process of living. We are doing all kinds of things with the mind. But most of the things we do are prejudicing it in one way or another. We want the mind to be the means of fulfilling everything in life that we desire. A mind that doesn't fulfill our wishes isn't much of an intellect as far as we are concerned. A mind that tells us to be temperate brings immediate objection. And what is the source of the objection? A counter-attitude of the mind itself. So the mind that gets us into trouble, the mind that gets us out of trouble, and the mind that keeps us alternating between one and the other for most of our lifetime, all this is one mysterious instrument that has the authority to over-influence the life of the person. The mind working in harmony with the emotions and protecting the rights of the body represents the best form of government that the human being can have. The mind, therefore, must be taught how to govern, and the results of its own instruction are proven by the emotional and physical consequences of thought. If the mind is right, the body will be reasonably well, and the emotions will be stable. If the mind loses its own integration or fails to maintain its proper relation with life, then the other two factors are immediately sickened. And we find that most of our thoughts these days have a tendency to deplete health or depress emotions. The world we live in today is a world which many people fear. They believe that the inevitable consequences of our mistakes must sometime descend upon us. But we seldom apply this to ourselves. We seldom think that the personal mistakes that we make every day are really going to be held against us. We feel, as far as that's concerned, that there are a lot of little things that God and nature have to overlook because we are not perfect after all. Well, no one really expects us to be perfect, but nature expects us to do a little better than the average person does. We are supposed to cooperate mentally, and in so doing, not only preserve the harmony of our own compound construction, but also to protect the world in which we live. Selfishness and cupidity and arrogance and all these bad emotional mental processes are destroying our planet. And the very policies which are wrecking the planet are held in the minds of people who are wrecking themselves by having those habits. This is something that's hard to believe, perhaps, but if we want to know what is happening and why it is happening, it is not necessary to climb the smoky sides of Sinai. It is only necessary to sit down quietly and reflect for a few moments upon the conditions of society, our own personal lives, and the attitudes by which we are dominated. If we do this, we will soon have the answer to most of the common questions. Now, in China, as we aforementioned, the doctrines of Confucius, though for a time outlawed by Mr. Mao, are now back in fashion, and it is now considered a part of education for the individual to realize that an education that enables him to be sick, poor, discontented, and driven by dictatorships is not much of an education, and the world isn't going to get very far on that diet of culture. Wherever we find things wrong, there is some kind of ignorance. And this ignorance is either natural or acquired. Natural ignorance you can do something with. Acquired is more difficult. Acquired ignorance largely arises from the individual's personal determination to break rules for his own benefit, failing to realize that this is utterly impossible. When he thinks he has broken some rule for his own benefit, he is simply laying up trouble for the future. There's no way of escaping it. So that the end of education, theoretically, is to produce the superior person. Now, superiority is not a standard factor. Superiority is actually the individual living from the best part of himself. It is the individual using the talents that he possesses as wisely and in such friendliness as is possible. The superior person is the one who lives according to the highest concepts of his own character, conduct, or background. There is no reason why a superior person has to be a genius. Many geniuses are hopelessly unbalanced. But a superior person must have the fundamentals of a civilized human being. Now, in order to have those fundamentals, something has to be done with the intellect, the mind which is hard to harness, the mind which is constantly resisting law and order, the mind which is concerned only in the fulfillment of ambitions and has very little time or thought for self-improvement. So the only way you can do anything with the mind is to get it young and stay with it until you make it do the things that it is supposed to do. This is a different approach to education from what we have now. What we are really now trying to do is help the mind to be sneaky and safe at the same time. We expect the mind to break the rules and live happily ever afterwards. And in order to convince us of this, it has rearranged the rules so that the mind is miseducated to go on and perpetuate the sorrows and miseries of the human race. So the Confucianists decided that the main point was to find out as far as we can what constitutes superiority. For superiority, when it is properly acquired, lifts the individual from a previous level of inadequacy. Superiority is not an ultimate in itself by one grand dash towards education. Superiority is a constant growing in which the individual constantly lives above his own mistakes and corrects them and does all that he can to advance his life. This is what we should have in school. The mind should be taught that the most important thing is that it should be a benevolent organizer and a benevolent executive. It is like a country. The country has a good ruler, the people flourish. If it has a bad ruler, they suffer. If the ruler is ambitious, runs them into wars, debt, and revolution, the same thing happens in the human body. The sick sets in, and there is no immediate cure for it. So the Confucian says, let's start by diagnosing the requirements of a superior person. Now, most people think they're superior. And even when they know they're not, they don't want anyone else to tell them so. Because there's certain pride in there also. We wish to be a success. and as we have set up a science of success as a result of breaking rules, we can break a few of them, and then the rules break us. So the Chinese says the first thing you have to do to teach the child is to give it the integrity necessary to develop into a purposeful person, a person who is superior. Now, what is a superior person? A superior person is one who is above committing inferior deeds. Anything that is destructive, anything that is selfish, anything that damages the public good or the private good must be considered as against the production of the superior person. The superior person must be a builder, not a wrecker. The superior person must put others before himself. He must recognize genius where it exists. He must serve integrity where he finds it. And in his personal life, he must keep the rules of the Confucian Code. And the Confucian Code is one of the earliest of the various world codes to include the statement that we should do unto others as we would wish that they would do unto us. It was integrity from the beginning. So the first step of education is to teach an individual what honesty is, why it is worthwhile, and why he must acquire it if he wishes to be happy. Now, he may find that he is surrounded by people who do not agree with this. And as we are likely to follow the leaders of our day, we soon lose sight of the problems of being superior, and very often end up by being inferior to the worst rather than superior to the best. So superiority includes a complete development of mental integration, a mind that in judgment is honest, a mind that is fair, a mind that is humane, a mind that is not self-centered to the degree that it will injure others to advance its own cause. A mind that is honest, is dedicated to purposes, and is a watchful and loving guardian of the emotional levels of the body and form, which we call human, and the larger emotional and physical body, which we call population. All of these things are part of a code. And the mind was given to us so that we can live well, do right, and be happy. What happened to it? Something went wrong. Because we are none of these things today. We are frightened, we are selfish, we are dishonorable, we are out to one purpose only, and that is to get ahead by cheating somebody else if necessary. And our idea of the superior person is the individual who in one way or another has accumulated wealth or power. And very difficult to collect either in large quantities without compromising principles. So the child in school has to start with the culturing of its mind. Now, education generally has never been very successful in culturing the mind. Most educational systems have been set up in countries, nations, and times in which corruption was common and prevalent. And education has gradually become a means of competing with that which is wrong. The mind has been taught to be more cunning than the mind of the neighbor. And the mind of the whole world is settled upon aggrandizement, upon domination, and upon conquest. All of these things are silly, stupid, and mortally dangerous. Now, we can believe, for instance, that we go along in our own personal lives, and that the mind is a fairly pleasant person to be with. It thinks rather nice thoughts as long as they're not very important thoughts. But where something very important comes up, the mind retires into its own pattern of exclusiveness and decides what it's going to do regardless to whether it's right or wrong. Now, a mind that is educated by television isn't in very good shape. A mind that depends upon the daily press for its cum laude is not in good shape either. Actually, the mind today is exposed to a system which is very detrimental, but is not likely to admit the fact that it is responsible for the system. We have a vicious circle here. By wrong thinking, we build a great empire, which we have to perpetuate by more wrong thinking. And in the long run, this empire collapses because it was wrong, and the thinking has not been able to take over sufficiently, honorably, to call the situation normal. It isn't normal. So we have to find out now how to work into this situation. And Taoism is a good way. We've got a group of meditation philosophies at the present moment that are gaining wide attention. People meditating on what? This is the big question. Meditation is a wonderful thing, but it doesn't get us anywhere unless it re-educates the mind. It cannot simply ignore the mind and keep on having bad habits and good thoughts. The policy won't work. We have to gradually find ways in meditation to get this meditative mood into the intellectual nature firmly enough so that the mind begins to correct its own mistakes rather than making more. The mind is a creature that can correct its own mistakes, but it seldom does so, because by the time the mistakes have been made and have been uncomfortably assimilated into conduct, the mind is not likely to change them. If it could change them, it would do so in the world also. And we would not, at the end of 5,000 years of so-called civilization, we won't have passed, as we have now, through the post-war years of a struggle which cost the lives of nearly 60 million human beings for no good whatever. Even the old boundaries haven't changed. The old grievances haven't changed. The old hopes have not been stimulated. The old faults have not been corrected. So what was the result of all this? A mental attitude which is wrong. This attitude held maybe by leaders at one time and by ambitious followers at another, or by hopeless persons who could make no contribution because they had never trained themselves to follow an internal conviction. So here we have this mind that is constantly a powerhouse and is constantly suffering from wrong behavior patterns. The first thing, perhaps, that we have to learn to do with the mind before we can get it anywhere is to gradually break down its sense of omnipotence. The individual who finally reaches a point where he can look at himself and say, "I was wrong," and mean it, is simply saying, "My mind betrayed me." When an individual can say, "I should have done it a different way, which would have been better, but we didn't do it that different way," again, the mind is responsible, for it has lured us on to the perpetuation of a mistake. If we want to find out the cause of broken homes, of bankruptcies, of narcotics and crime, of moral delinquency and political tyranny, we have to go back to the mind box, for that is the box from which all of Pandora's difficulties come forth. Every problem we have is from the mind, and every cure we have ever tried to make was also from the mind. So these processes are locked in a tyranny in which gradually appetites, which are natural to immature persons, take precedence. And we live to cater to our feelings rather than to our facts. We continue to break rules because we find a certain immediate satisfaction, and then wake up someday faced with a huge penalty which we are unable to meet. So the great problem is to use the mind. In India, it is said in the Bhagavad Gita that the mind is the slayer of the real. And yet, we were not given a mind by the divine power, because it slew things. We are not given the mind because we don't need it. It is part of the compound of created things. And this compound is bestowed by a wisdom far greater than our own. It comes from a source of life which has decided that to think is one of the important processes of growth. So we have to go into the problem of thinking and try to decide what is a thought and what is an opinion. What is a fact and what is a fable? How are we going to prove to our own satisfaction that things that are wrong will not be righted merely by perpetuating them? Well, the thoughtful person sits down, like Omar the tent maker, and begins to contemplate these matters and can get a liberal education very quickly. Because when one country invades another, when the Iranians attack the Iraqis, the same thing is happening inside ourselves on a smaller scale. We are opposing, attacking, incapacitating elements of our own temperaments in an effort to attain some kind of an unreasonable sovereignty of a part over the whole. Actually, all nature is asking of man is that he will use his compound temperament, disposition, and integration to advance the common good of himself and others of his kind. The parts of man must work together, or there is some kind of a war in the body. The nations of society must work together, for tyranny will ultimately destroy society. So we have the human body as a miniature for all the processes that are going on around us in society. That we can learn from this is obvious. The only thing we need to do is think about it. In other words, we can begin to use the mind to solve its own mistakes. And this is more or less a sheer genius. But it was something we were intended to do. It is not unreasonable. It is not a fantastic impossible that we can never hope to accomplish. Many serious, thoughtful people can accomplish it if they want to. And as a few do improve, the majority will follow to some degree. So as we sit around and watch all these things that are happening, some people will turn on the newsreels, news on the television, listen and say, oh, it's all terrible. Others will turn it off because they don't want to hear it. A third group does not believe a word of it. And still another group is fighting to some political purpose which it has assumed to be significant. All of these things are a great expenditure of energy and nothing to help the mind. Most people in thinking feed the mind on junk foods. And as a result of that, it brings out some very junky decisions, which are not necessary, inevitable, or useful. If, however, we really want to start a little thinking, there's plenty of it here to do, plenty of chance to do it. But decisions have to be made. There are penalties or prices upon everything in nature. The penalty for a misdeed is misery. The price of a good deed is intelligence. The individual must use the faculties that he has the way they were intended to be used if he expects to benefit from them. There is no one who is any better off by being completely under the tyranny of his own intellect or of a collective group of intellects. A whole group of people coming to wrong decisions does not result in a correct decision. In this case, the majority is not always right. The majority is not right now because the majority doesn't think at all, or is so selfish and self-centered that it doesn't care. So we start in by deciding that the mind is a potential savior, the energies of which are being ruthlessly wasted. Now, how do we try to do this? Well, there are two ways. We must ultimately, of course, work it into our educational system. We must begin to train the mind to think and not to inherit the notions of other people. We have to train the mind to contribute to the future rather than build all of its wealth and strength upon the past. The past is important, but only to the degree it gives us true insights into the repetition of ancient policies. So we have to start in either by going to school in a different type of educational theory, more like that of Comenius, who gave us the public school in the beginning but unfortunately died too soon, about 300 years too soon, to be able to control the system after it passed out of his keeping. Comenius was very simple in his ideas. He says it's very easy to over-educate people. When you over-educate a person above his and beyond his capacities, you have a misfortune and a desperately unhappy person. So education should be appropriate to the needs. And education should begin always in moral instruction. It should begin by a proper use of emotion as a curb upon thought. If the emotions of charity, love, piety, faith, and all of the kindlier feelings, if these emotions are cultivated constructively, they can definitely influence the mind. The mind can be changed by the use of other faculties which man possesses. Also, the mind can be altered considerably by the physical body, because after a while, the mistakes of the mind show up there in terms that cannot be contradicted. So the mind has to gradually realize that it is not the Lord of all it surveys, that it cannot do anything that it wants to do and not be punished. The mind must come to the realization that it exists primarily to learn what is right and do it. Now, this does not mean that life is going to become a dull monotony or that for lack of mistakes we have nothing to live for. It is because of the fact that the values, joys, securities, and the wonderful internal experiences of being right are more lasting and more satisfying than the result of any vice that can be cultivated. So we can hope that people will quietly sit down and begin looking around them and looking within them. Looking around to see what's the matter with the families around them, what's the matter with the business that is falling apart, why they can't speak to their relatives anymore, why their children are delinquent. All these things they can notice. And they can also do what a number of groups are doing now, organizing themselves against these delinquencies. It is becoming more and more obvious that bad habits are endangering the survival of civilization. Well, bad habits are simply basically bad mental attitudes, wrong thinking, wrong decisions about what is good and what is bad. Now, a lot of people say that we already have this information. We do. There are very few people in this world who do not know right from wrong. But they do have other pressures that are stronger. Instead of being concerned with right and wrong, they are concerned with what they want, what they wish to do. If it's revenge, they want to have it. If it's some kind of argument, they want to enjoy it. And they feel perfectly right and free to elect the wrong persons to public office. These things are not part of the discipline that we need, but they are coming out all around us. What we need is more and more thoughtfulness, the education of the mind in realities. The education of the mind that when it says, I think I will go out and buy some cocaine, immediately the mind itself says, no, you don't, because you can see, know, hear, read, and observe the consequences of such a conduct. There is no law that says that you have to be a narcotics addict. The only reason is that because it gives you a temporary feeling of omniscience. You suddenly feel you are bigger than anybody else, but you suddenly realize that you are smaller than most people by the time it's over. There is no advancement, but we do it. So the mind says, let's go out and buy this material, or go into bankruptcy trying to pay for it. Now, all this is not the result of a bad mind. It is the result of a bad use of a potentially good mind. Or perhaps it is calling upon more strength of character than we possess. But if we haven't got the strength of character, the mind will bill it for us if we are willing to accept. So the mind can pick out every fault that there is in society today and finally add to it the consequence of the fact that we personally are committing these faults, and it's all being shown to us clearly through arteriosclerosis and other symptoms of bodily distress. We are actually a single creature. Our thoughts, our emotions, and our bodies are part of one entity. And when we shortchange any of the parts, the whole suffers. The same with a nation. A nation that is well governed must consider all the needs of all the people. It must defend itself against the extravagances of some individuals who wish to break faith with the integrities of life. Same with the person. When we are ready to break faith with integrity, we are on our way to all kinds of difficulties. Now, most people are not such marvelous, terribly important people that they can necessarily worry too much about some of these problems. What they really need to do is to get down to the small things of life and try to work them out. In our own little way, we have headaches, dyspepsia, indigestion. Anacin and its byproducts, largest selling drug in the United States, because it is a treatment for a headache. Now, headaches are sometimes legitimate, but more often misconduct is the basis of headaches. The individual with the headache is the one who is worried when he should have thought, an individual who ate what he should not have eaten, an individual who got into an argument that he should not have gotten into, or have all kinds of negative, destructive fears, anxieties, worries, and antagonisms until he gets so miserable that he has to take some more aspirin. Now, aspirin is not a cure for anything. It reduces symptoms for a little bit. But the only cure for the difficulties that aspirin is taken for is clear thinking. The individual, by thinking himself through this maze of his own misconducts, can find a way to remove most of his headaches. Those that remain may represent need of personal, medical or psychological attention. The individual may have to go down as far as his diet in order to find the roots of some of his headaches. But most of his headaches come from above, because the headache, as is implied, is in the head. And it's in the head where the headache arises, in the mind. Now, the brain is not responsible. That poor little hunk of flesh is just doing the best it can. It has been given over to the custody of a heartless taskmaster. It is a slave to the will of the mind behind it. It has nothing to do or nothing to say but to transmit the impulses, good or bad, to some other part of the body that is being affected or they hope will be affected. So there is no way out of this unless the individual realizes that the mind has as its primary purpose not ingenuity but integrity. We think the mind is a great thing these days when it invents a computer. That really is the answer. Already people don't know what to do with them. The problem of computers is already assuming gigantic proportions. Another individual might point out that we are indebted to the mind for putting a man on the moon. Yeah, it's probably true. The mind was having a grand time on its own, with no consideration for the rest of the body which belongs to it. The landing the man on the moon was a scientific achievement, but the real problems of life were not touched by it. They then decided they'd land one on Mars. They can go on until they land one in the Milky Way, but it still will not prevent the common mistakes we make here every day.